Good morning, everyone. It's really so great to be here with all of you today, and it's great to be part of the LivaNova leadership team. You know, what I thought I would first do is address one of your concerns. I think you've all probably seen and had some concerns about the consistency of our delivery of our financial results. And one of the first things I want to tell you and reassure you is that we're very committed to delivering on our financial commitments. You know, many of you know I have spent 25 years with Johnson & Johnson. And being a financial leader in Johnson & Johnson, one of the first things and the primary things that we were told is to deliver on your commitments. And so what I'm going to do with all of you over time is build and ensure we have trust, transparency, and delivery of our commitments. So today, I'm going to share with you three main reasons why I'm confident about our future and where we're going. I'm going to share with you the financial roadmap, our outlook. First of all, one of the reasons I'm confident about our commitment to deliver is that we have momentum. You know, we're off to a great start this year. We're going to continue to build momentum. The second reason, as Damian pointed out, is that we have a very clear strategy for growth. You know, I don't know about you, but I'm very excited about the opportunities that we have. I think being very focused in what you can drive and deliver is key. And also, the number three reason is what Damian said, is that we're being much more disciplined. You know, discipline is everything. You know, measuring the critical things and having that discipline and rigor is how you execute and drive results. So for us, it's really about delivering sustainable and profitable growth. So let's get into it. First of all, I'm very pleased with the results that we had in the first half of the year. I think we showed in the second quarter strong earnings performance. We saw expanding margin. We have very disciplined spending, and we're very focused in R&D. We're also bringing a new cadence of new product innovation, as well as integrating Caisson. We're also on track to deliver our synergy targets of $80 million by the end of 2018. And we're being much more disciplined in managing our channel inventory levels, particularly in emerging markets, which is key. And as well, and I think it's really an important thing to note, that we have a very strong balance sheet and low debt levels, so it gives us a lot of room to kind of further expand and build on our platform. Looking at the first half, and I was very proud of the results that we delivered, with the exception of growth. And I think one of the things that we have to do is further ramp up the growth story, and I'll talk more about that. But we grew 1% on a constant currency basis. Our adjusted margin was up 100 basis points, or gross margin. And adjusted operating margin was up 210 basis points. And we grew EPS, adjusted EPS, by 22% versus prior year. Now, I don't know about you, this is a great progress, but it's not something that we're satisfied with. And it's not at benchmark levels. So again, we want to very much focus, and I'll talk to you about our plans to further improve as we go forward. With these first half results, though, we are reiterating our guidance for the full year, as we said in the second quarter call on August 9th. Looking at the top line, and to me, this is, I think, a very key slide. If you take one story about where we're going, this one. You know, looking at where we are today, we've been a low single-digit growth company. 1-3 is our guidance for the year. Good, but not, you know, market-leading. Our businesses today, the organic growth of cardiac surgery is low single digit. Alistair is going to talk more about how do we get that up, how do we ramp that growth over time. Neuromod has been growing well today at a high single digit rate. You know, Jason's going to talk more about how we ramp that up as well. Damian mentioned the strategic portfolio initiatives. And so when you look at just the organic and making the portfolio choices that we talked about this morning, we think the Neuromod cardiac surgery businesses on an organic basis can get us to a mid-single-digit growth business on a CAGR. But the SPIs, I think, as Damien said, any single one of them could be a multiple $100 million opportunity. We really believe that. We have, in our strategic plan and our forecast here and what we're presenting, assumed $200 million-$300 million coming from all three combined. And just that alone would get us to a mid to high single-digit company. Now, I don't know about you, but I think companies that grow well beyond the market, high single-digit growth companies, are companies that win. And I think there's a tremendous opportunity with us in M&A to go even further. And we could be a very, very clearly, in my view, a high single-digit growth company. So again, midterm, organic, mid-single-digit. More near-term, I think we could go to a high single-digit, mid to high single-digit, and then longer-term, high single-digit. So let's talk about margin. I've spent a lot of time in medical devices as well as pharma. And this is a fundamental issue that we have to improve upon. Being in the mid-60s is not going to sustain us. And I think, frankly, pricing discipline is everything. So I'm taking a lot of my experience from pharma and also med devices at J&J, and we're really going to focus on greater pricing discipline, but also building pricing strategic capabilities that will allow us to expand our margin. I don't know about you, but you've probably seen the complexity that we have also in the supply chain. Many med device companies over time sell everything everywhere. I think being much more disciplined on your SKU rationalization, what you sell, having a more profitable mix is going to be key. And so we have plans year-over-year to improve our gross margin, and we're targeting a gross margin at a minimum of 70% by 2022. Damien talked a little bit about some of the initiatives. We have a lot of things going on, but to me, really focusing on improving our profitability is key. And so we built, and we have now, which we didn't have in the past, really strong direct and indirect procurement capabilities. We're building that out further. We're doing a lot more around vendor negotiations and management. It seems like simple blocking and tackling, but it's really important for us to drive margin. We're also consolidating our footprint. We've made the decision to get out of certain plants. We're going to continue to look at real estate and make sure that we're doing the best things that we could do to have a more profitable business as we go forward. In addition, we're doing a lot right now to build in capabilities like SAP, which is really fundamental. But at the same time, we know that our admin costs are high. And so we're bringing COEs and really streamlining our processes with admin to really reduce our costs. So to me, I think there's a tremendous opportunity for us to improve the cost, the GP, and reduce the cost of goods sold, but also reduce SG&A over time. To me, for us to really be a growth company, the key enabler is innovation and R&D. And so I was very proud and I'm very happy to join to see us acquire Caisson. I think this is a game changer for us, and I think ultimately will really help us accelerate our growth for the long term. But it requires additional investment. I think you would all see that investments in R&D will pay out. And I think to me, the bets that we're placing are really solid and really foundational. If you look at where we were 2 years ago, we were basically investing between 9%-11% in R&D. And I would argue a lot of that wasn't even productive. So having the R&D investments be very focused in key areas. I'm very good at portfolio management. I've done this a lot in my career, both in pharma and in devices, placing the right bets, having the discipline to really focus on a few areas and drive it. I think during the next few years, we're going to ramp up our R&D investment. We're going to do it with Caisson, going to 11%-12% this year, but then with also the other strategic portfolio investments and supporting M&A, we think that we need to invest roughly 12%-13% in the near term to help accelerate the growth longer term. With all that said, we believe very clearly, because we're not at benchmark levels today in our operating margin, we can both improve and grow. And so through the gross margin expansion initiatives, the SG&A reduction, but then with having an R&D expansion, we believe we can go from high teens to over 20% in the next 5 years. Our EPS growth, we're very focused on getting that to kind of a consistent low to mid-teens CAGR over the next 5 years and nearly doubling where we are today. In addition, I think being very disciplined on how we deploy capital is everything. You know, I know we get a lot of questions on what we're doing, and certainly, you know, where we've been, we haven't had the best cash conversion, but we've been integrating. We've been investing quite a lot with integrating the company. We've been investing quite a lot in deploying cash with restructuring efforts. The good news, a lot of that's now working behind us, and now going forward, our cash conversion is going to be much more positive and more in line with our income growth. And so to me, I believe our capital allocation strategy and our priorities are very clear. First is to provide liquidity to support the business, to support the growth strategy. So as we see opportunities to acquire businesses, or we see opportunities to expand globally, internationally, to expand our markets, which are underpenetrated, we want to have the cash and the firepower to go after that. We also want to increase our shareholder returns, and I think that will come naturally as we grow and become a growth company, as well as a margin improvement company. And so we have also, because of our balance sheet, I think a very unique and strong position for a company of our size. I think having the low debt, positive cash, it allows us some room and capacity to lever up if we find the right M&A opportunities. And so we think that roughly 2 to 3 times our EBITDA, net debt to EBITDA, is a possibility. But again, we're going to make very disciplined and focused decisions. You know, I think you would want us as investors and analysts to be very disciplined in our acquisition approach and where we invest our dollars. And I think Damien and I are very clear as the leadership team that there's tremendous opportunities in the areas that we have already. And we're going to look at deals, which I would describe are more tuck-in deals, deals that we could basically build out and strengthen our positions in neuromodulation and cardiac surgery. And you see that strategy playing through on our cash flow. I think we'll double our cash flow roughly over the next 5 years. Obviously, net income growth will be a key driver, improving the cash conversion, working capital. You know, I also say in my experience living and working in emerging markets in places like China and Russia, cash is king. You know, having good working capital, being very disciplined on AR and inventory levels is everything. And I'll tell you, frankly, when I came in, you know, I was not surprised, but I would say I saw an opportunity for us to bring our inventory levels down, our AR levels down, by being more focused on this. And I think one of the key examples is also the number of distributors and number of customers. You know, when you're selling everything everywhere, then you're going to have a lot of challenges and you're going to have a lot of inventory. So again, being very focused is really going to help us. And again, focusing in two very clear areas, I think, is really going to drive our growth. Damien showed this slide, but I just want to give you my perspective on it, which I think is it's really about a growth and margin expansion story. We can do both. And we can do both by improving our margin in cardiac surgery. We have a great position. So let's bring in some other things around that position and leverage that. You know, you don't need to add another sales force, but you can really leverage the capability that we have. Neuromod, to me, the number of indications that we have and the possibilities are incredible. Jason's going to talk a lot more about that. We can both invest in things and programs that we have today, but we can also acquire new things and expand that position. And then TMVR, I mean, look, this is a huge area. I think we've all seen what other companies have done in the space. It's competitive, but I think that we can win, and I honestly believe that we can also bring in some other things to strengthen our position there. And again, I think we have to place some bets. I think it's a very thoughtful investment with key decision points, key milestones in heart failure. So again, I hope that you are as excited as I am. I think that this is a tremendous growth opportunity. If you look at where and how we're going to create shareholder value creation, it's going to be a combination of revenue growth, going from today, what is, a low single-digit growth company to a mid in the near term into a high single-digit growth company in the long term. Very clear path to me. Very clear. We have huge markets that we can expand upon. We have a global opportunity that we're not even touching. We're just starting, I would say, in the emerging markets. And we also have great, great opportunities in innovation and M&A. At the same time, it's very clear to me that we can improve our EPS. We know that we've had some inefficiencies. We know that we have opportunities to be a world-class type of company in improving our EPS in a profitability. And I think that growing low to mid-teens on a CAGR basis is exactly what you would expect. And I also think that you would expect from us to be very disciplined, very focused on how we deploy capital. Damien said, we're a different leadership team. And we're going to deploy capital that I think you would all support. And at the end of the day, see that LivaNova as a growth engine. So again, I want to thank you for being here. I want to thank you for your confidence in LivaNova. And I look forward to taking your questions. With that, I'd like to invite Karen and Damien. Thank you.
Questions? Yeah, go ahead. Actually, thank you. Lori, Deanna, somebody that has a microphone? We need one up here.
Matt, there's one up the front.
Yeah, we asked that actually you hold your questions until you get the mic so that everybody on the webcast can hear.
Thank you, Damien and Thad, for that introduction to the business. A lot going on. I'm Jason Mills from Canaccord Genuity. I have two questions to start. On the M&D side, could you give us your definition of a tuck-in acquisition, both in terms of the characteristics of size that you're looking for and the characteristics of margins and growth that you'd be looking for? And then sort of related, with respect to your announced planned divestiture of the CRM business, on slide 10, you talked about your roadmap, Damien, for value creation, and you sort of split it up in time periods, mm-hmm. The first one being 2017 and 18. Is the divestiture to the CRM business critical to be able to achieve the goals within that those bullets under the 2017 and 18 time frame? So those that's sort of one question. The second question has to do with cardiac surgery, and maybe I'll come back and ask that after you.
Why don't I do the the divestiture bit first? So the short version of a longer story is it's not critical to, but it's an enabler of. So moving that portfolio out of the broader portfolio is definitely going to enable us to do a lot of other things. But we could have elected to keep that in and try to continue to invest and get the whack of that company back up towards the fleet average. But so it's not critical, but it's an enabler. And so in the 17-18 time period, we expect it to be hopefully find a home and be out of the portfolio. And certainly, it's going to give us some flexibility in terms of the balance sheet to be able to do some other things. But to that, so let's talk about the M&A.
Well, yeah, and look, that will help us both in terms of growth, margin, and cash conversion. So, again, we're very focused on what I describe tuck-in deals, because tuck-in deals are more, what I would say, bringing it right into the rep's bag. You know, not having to create a new sales force or a whole new team, building on what we have today. And so we're looking for revenue opportunities in the next year or two with accretive businesses in a year or two. Like, I'm not looking for things that are big cash burn, for example. So I think through that strategy, and we have some targets in mind that we're assessing right now.
You have, with respect to M&A tuck-in size, sort of,
Yeah.
They need to be of a certain size?
Yeah, I think to me, and again, others have played this before, you know, going small and trying to find the best science and not overpaying and getting your valuations with higher returns is important. Yeah, I would see these being, you know, in the around $100 million types of acquisitions, you know, plus minus. But, you know, we're not going to take a $500 million bet on just one thing at this point.
Thank you. And then, sort of related to that, on the cardiac surgery side, as you look for M&A to tuck in to a sales force, could you give us a sense for the size of your direct distribution, sales force teammates, both in the United States and outside the United States, into which you would be plugging in to specifically a cardiac surgery asset you may look to purchase? Thank you for taking the question.
Well, most of our business in the U.S. is direct. So things that we would bring into the U.S. bag is direct. Really, the only place where we have a distribution partnership structure is in the what we're now calling the international markets. We used to call them emerging markets, but the international markets. And there, what we've really done, and this is again to set us up for this long term, is started being much more disciplined about how many dealers. I mean, we candidly had never met a dealer we didn't like. And you know, the inventory in the channel and a lot of our margin discipline really went away because we had so many dealers. We've brought a new leadership team into that group. Roy Khoury, some of you know, has brought a talented group of people underneath him. Already, we're starting to see that read through. They've reduced the number of distributors in their geography by about a third in the last 9 months. We're starting to see that really read through in their growth rate. We're not going to talk about it much here today, but the international team, I think, is really going to be one of the gems for us. You know, we talked about the geographic expansion. But you know, their growth rates increased, their gross margins have improved in the last 9 months, and as I said, we've reduced the footprint. So the dealer aspect of it is really in emerging markets. The rest of the business is really direct. Yeah, we don't really split out the those businesses and, you know, maybe, you know, we can talk about how we add more clarity to that over time. But, you know, you can see from the chart that cardiac is clearly going to be a big part of who we are.
Do you want to bring the mic over?
Mic right here.
Oh.
Mic.
Okay.
Oh, we got one back.
So Matt O'Brien, Piper Jaffray.
Hey.
Just for clarification purposes, good morning. Is the roadmap that you laid out as far as profitability goes, does that include or exclude the divestiture of the CRM?
All the financials include CRM that I've presented.
Okay, so anything else would be incremental above that.
Correct.
So can you talk a little bit about that business? Quickly looking at the 10-K, looks like it lost about $32 million that was in 2018.
Right.
So can you talk about the profitability of that business? $5 million, something in that range?
Yeah, I mean, what we disclosed last year was a loss, and if you look at the Q this year, it's a slight gain, so it's a little bit accretive.
Then just how difficult would it be to track that business? How integrated, what other areas does it touch and that process?
Yeah. Yeah, that's a good question. Look, it's a relatively standalone business. The business in the U.S. is relatively small, so extracting the commercial organization in the U.S., we believe will be relatively simple. In Europe, there was some commercial integration as a result of the LivaNova merger. But again, it's quite well defined, especially at the sales rep level, and the operating units are very separate. Clamart and Saluja, you know, Clamart is a standalone CRM division, and in Saluja, it's a very well-defined area within the Saluja manufacturing plant. So, we intend, you know, assuming we find a buyer and someone that's willing to take this on as a growth opportunity, we intend to run this as an integration in reverse. We'll bring the discipline that we know about and we've used over our careers to treating this divestiture as an integration in reverse. And so we think that there's a pathway to it. We think that it won't be relatively traumatic for the company. Of course, what we're really interested in is making sure our associates in that organization know the pathway. And you know, we're very concerned and have spent a lot of time, and especially the last 24 hours, talking to them to make sure they understand how we intend to transition them.
Yes, Scott. You can.
Hi, Scott.
Yeah. Very much taking the question. Scott Bardo from Berenberg. So obviously pleasing to see that you've formalised considering your strategic options for CRM. Can you just talk a little bit about confidence levels surrounding that sale? Have you already received expressions of interest? And perhaps just go further as to if you don't receive a price which you deem creating value for your shareholders, what's the plan B? Can you go back and fold this business back into the organization?
Yeah, so thanks, Scott. I was actually expecting one of your multi-part nine-point questions.
It's coming. It's coming.
Those of you that know Scott from the calls know that he has a trigger. Look, it's very early in the cycle, and you know, we're exploring the process. We've appointed Barclays as our advisor to work us through that process. So beyond that, you know, until we get to a definitive decision, we're probably not going to talk that much more about it. But I'm confident that people will see the value of the organization. And I think that, you know, again, this strong regional footprint, you know, Europe and Japan, you know, Japan's really growing quite well, I think is compelling for a number of people. I think the fact that there's some really tremendous technology, I mean, you know the headwinds here with the MRI and the leads, but, you know, there's a pathway through that. And I think that people will see that. And then there's the technology that the group have around sonar. And again, I believe that people see that. So beyond that, we're really focused on finding the right home and a buyer that wants to be, you know, having this asset as part of their growth plan. So don't have much more detail beyond that.
Can't confirm whether you've had any expressions of interest.
No.
You won't do that. And just a point of clarification again, thanks, Fad, for giving the sort of financial roadmap over the next few years. Just to understand that the earnings targets have here and the top-line targets, we should think of these as organic targets, so acquisitions would be potentially incremental to
Correct.
These targets.
Yeah. I show the three kind of the three levels. So it's organic, and then you have the SPI, and then the M&A. So the M&A is not included in the EPS at all.
Thanks. I just really wanted to understand a little bit better and square your operating margin expectations with that of the gross margin. Because I think you highlight an ambition of some 500 basis points gross margin expansion over the next 5 years.
Right.
And when you look at your R&D slide, you're also assuming over a five-year period that ratio falls.
Mm-hmm.
And you talked also about SG&A work down. But when I look to your operating margin target, you know, one would expect some 600 basis points improvement following
right.
that logic, but it doesn't appear to follow in what you're saying.
Yeah.
So can you explain a little bit? What am I missing there?
Yeah, no, look, first of all, and again, I said at the beginning, I want to provide, I think, realistic and reasonable expectations here. Clearly, even going beyond 70% is something I would like us to achieve. There's a lot of work to be done to get there. And so, again, it's a five-year projection. Of course, we're going to give you regular updates on how we're progressing against each of these. You know, I also think we want to be prudent in our expectations. I didn't talk about tax. Tax could go up. Tax could go down. And depending on the scenarios, you know, we have actions in place to reduce tax. But again, trying to create a kind of a reasonable expectation.
Just to understand the logic that in your mind there could be good reason to assume operational leverage over and above gross margin improvement. Is that?
That's a fair thing to say.
Carl Eric was having a little chuckle there.
Yeah.
He didn't know how many
Deanna.
Questions you had in your
you.
Quiver.
Hi, I'm Mike Matson from Needham & Company. Just with regard to the sale of the CRM business, you know, what do you plan to do with the cash from that when and if it happens?
Well, look, I mean, one of the things, obviously, we talked about the kind of the cash deployment and where we're going. Of course, you know, there are opportunities to do acquisitions and, to me, accelerate the growth of the company. And in my previous life, I mean, divesting or making portfolio choices, but then acquiring other things is a way to really accelerate the growth of the company. If we can't do that for whatever reason, we'll obviously look at, you know, share buybacks. I mean, we have approval up to $150 million. We've done $50 million already. So again, depending on the scenario.
Okay, thanks. And then your guidance for R&D implies about a 3% increase relative to pre the Caisson acquisition. So that implies, you know, around $30 million of incremental spending a year. Is that really enough to cover the cost of TMVR and all these other pipeline projects that you have?
Yeah, that's roughly what we're looking at. I think that the combination, and again, they're all in different places. So like even heart failure is a bit further out. TMVR, we've included that already. And then also we have some investments in supporting depression as well. So it's a little higher than 30, I would say. But, you know, we think that we have enough set aside to support all three initiatives.
I think there's the big thing that doesn't read through here is, you know, our productivity. We're doing a lot of portfolio management. Again, you know, I make this joke, we never met a project we didn't like. There was a lot of skunk works stuff going on. We've really pared that bit down. We took one of our best project managers out of the Houston group, and we've tasked her with building a whole new portfolio management process coupled with a product development, the PDP process. Those two things, I think, are going to give us some leverage inside the existing R&D spend that I don't think was previously considered, so.
Yeah, getting rid of the tail of kind of low productive products and really focusing on those key ones, I think will really pivot R&D investment.
And then do you have some sort of estimate of the cumulative cost that's going to be required to bring Caisson to market in the U.S. through the FDA approval?
We do, yeah.
Can you give us some idea?
Glad you asked. Glad you asked, and yes.
Yeah.
No, we're not going to disclose the program, but I will tell you that, you know, when we've talked to you guys about where we're thinking about being disciplined, you know, the IRRs have to be, you know, mid to high teens. We're right in that sweet spot. And, you know that the cumulative purchase price for that asset was much lower than a lot of the other assets in that market. What these guys have done, what 42 people did with 10,000 sq ft is really extraordinary. And so we really are focused on keeping them as productive as that, but, you know, while giving them a lot more breathing room. And the reason for bringing Caisson in when we did was that I didn't want them managing to a milestone. And, you know, some of their discussions in that first two or three months, you know, CJ and Todd, I could tell were very passionate about bringing the product to market, but were thinking about the milestone for the next funding. And I wanted them to not think about that. I wanted them to think about being first or second to market. I wanted them to think about bringing the best product to market. I wanted them to be able to afford to bring guys like Paul on board. And, you know, those things were really important. We can leverage our regulatory department, our clinical department, our ops group. I mean, already the ops group has made a number of trips to Minneapolis about how to bring the production capabilities to bear. And so it was really about accelerating it. So I actually think there's a bunch of leverage in the program because we brought them on board.
All right. Thanks a lot.
No worries.
Thank you.
Any more questions?
In the front here.
Hi, it's Matt Miksic from UBS. Just to follow up on the questions around strategic investment. And you talked about sort of like plus or minus $100 million. But love to get a sense of, you know, Caisson represents emerging growth opportunity in clinicals. How do you balance finding tuck-ins that are going to help you drive growth near term without necessarily investing in assets that may not be kind of part of this transition towards minimally invasive and transcatheter therapies that we're seeing in all your kind of cardiac end markets?
Yeah, look, I view my role as a portfolio manager in some ways. I mean, making decisions in terms of things that we're going to invest against and things that we're not, and making choices. And I think even this morning's announcement is really about making a choice. And so that focus, you know, will allow us to free up resources to be more productive, to go deeper into where we're spending our R&D dollars, and to free up some room to then, you know, place some bets. And so that's exactly what we're doing. I think that, you know, relatively speaking, going from, you know, 9% to 11% to 12% to 13% is not that big of a deal, to be honest. I think you would want us to, if we can show that we're growing in the caisson and you know, depression or delivering on what we say, it's a good investment. And so, I'm not going to get into how much each one is today, but the caisson deal alone is, I think, one of the best acquisitions I've seen in a while. And we certainly didn't overpay for it. And we had 49% position for many years to see how it was going to play out. And then you acquired a very modest price, I would say, for the market with a lot of upside. And so, yes, we're going to have to invest in R&D, but it's a 2 to 3 year investment. So, again, I'm maybe deflecting, but I'm excited about that.
Any more questions? Back here, Deanna.
Hi, Rick Wise, Stifel. Just back to the CRM divestiture. It sounds like you'd prefer to sell it and get the cash. Are there circumstances that you consider actually just spinning the company off into an entity? Is that a possible option on the table? Thank you.
We looked at all of that in our discussions. The board had some really robust opinions about all of the options, and you know, we beat this up pretty solidly with them. Right now, we're just focused on finding a home with a buyer that values the assets that I described, and that's really, you know, where we're putting all our energy. But I will tell you, we looked at the whole gamut. When we said, you know, strategic review, it really was a strategic review. And again, the board is broadly very experienced. You know, some of you know Art and Al, Art Rosenthal and Al Novak. You know, they've been in a lot of places. You know, Dan Moore made some tough decisions at Cyberonix. You know these guys. So it was a robust conversation, and we looked at all of those options.
Thanks for giving me a chance to follow up. So clearly your strategy in cardiac surgery in some ways looks to leverage a call point that you have there with the cardiac surgeon. As we think about Kaizen, that call point ultimately with your fully transvenous approach, clearly it's going to have a cardiac surgery component to it, but in many ways is interventional cardiology.
Yeah.
So as we think about trying to you trying to get in front of that call point sooner rather than later,
mm-hmm.
really know how else to ask this other than what do you think of TAVR as part of your portfolio? And
yeah.
there aren't many assets left out there. We know the one or two that may be left out there. Maybe you know of more, but would TAVR be a consideration?
Yeah. So shorter answer, but a longer conversation sometime if you want. So, yes, it would be a consideration. But we've dismissed it. We don't believe that, you know, TAVR is an essential part of what we need to do to be successful in TMVR. One of the headwinds of being in CRM where we are is that we're fifth and a long way fifth. I think being, you know, fourth and a long way fourth in TAVR would be, putting us back in the same situation. I think a couple of things. There's other ways to get the interventional cardiology, one of which is to hire and build out a team. And one of the things that one of my first jobs at J&J was leading the Cordis team. So I've got years of interventional in my blood, as do you and as do the guys here. I think clinicians and commercial organizations will follow the best product. But I think we could organically build out an IC team. That's the first thing. Second thing is, I think there might be other assets, excluding TAVR, that might give us an opportunity to look at that. But again, not necessary. And then lastly, as I said, I don't think TAVR is something that we really want to dive into. Scott.
Yeah. Thank you. Very quick follow-up. Thanks for taking it. Obviously, the SPI investments are exciting, but there's a bit of sex and violence. You know, there's some risk profile ascribed. So the question I have is very direct.
Is that going to be in your notes?
Maybe. Do you think that you can still deliver that sort of earnings growth profile
yeah.
in the absence of any contribution from these programs?
Yeah. I mean, look, that's why we're here. I think, to me, getting the organic growth running and getting that, you know, cadence, there's a huge difference between 1 and 3. in 5 and 7. I mean, you know, a company that's growing 1% is always kind of struggling just to get the earnings growth. When you're growing 5 to 7, you know, and inflation's, you know, not as much of an issue, you don't have to restructure every year. You know, at the same time, I see still huge opportunities. You know, we don't have the procurement discipline that what I'm used to. You know, I think, you know, obviously some of the choices with manufacturing footprint. I mean, there's a lot of things that we could be doing, just being more disciplined. Damien and I both have a great level of experience and appreciation for dashboards, metrics, and accountability. You set goals, what gets measured gets done. You set really aggressive goals on cost savings. You work with, you know, the consultants who all want to help us, and you go after it. You hold teams accountable. And so we're setting all those things up. I think organic growth, getting the EPS up, and then supporting, you know, investments in R&D will take us to a whole nother level.
But I think that's why you referred to it as, you know, any one of the three hitting, and those shots on goal,
right,
could build a multi-$100 million group. We see those as three shots on goal. There's risks and a different risk profile with each one of them. But, you know, we believe, you know, that all of them have a chance of being major contributors as we view them right now. If one of them doesn't hit, okay, that's what,
right,
you know, R&D programs are about. But we believe that, you know, all of these shots on goal are really viable and valid. The teams behind them are tremendous. I mean, we spent a ton of time with the Minneapolis team on Kaison. Depression isn't, you know, again, unproven. It's been approved in the U.S. 05, right? Yeah. So 2005 was the approval in the U.S. You know, now the CMS coverage decision, clearly, you know, an issue, but where we are with our discussions there is, you know, very fruitful. So it's not something that we have to invent. And, you know, we know how to do it. It's just about getting reimbursement. And that's why we're taking the bet on the German market, to really prove out the treatment pathway. How do you move from a psychiatrist to the implanting surgeon back to the psychiatrist again? So it's not a clinical risk.
Right.
It's a pathway to reimbursement. And then lastly, with heart failure, look, ART is not really being leaned into by anyone. And as I said, we believe we understand where the other trials failed in terms of patient dosing and patient selection. We believe we've got a clinical pathway, and so do the FDA with the EAP. So, again, there's clinical risk attached to that, but we think we've leaned into that to minimize
with clear milestones even in how to mitigate and manage the risk. If we see that it's working at a certain point, then we'll continue.
Yeah.
If it's not, then...
Actually, that's one of the reasons we candidly took the investment thesis here is, when I originally started looking at it internally, the way it was being couched was, you know, the investment was X. And when Thad and I were sitting there, he said, it's not really X. It's really, you know, a part of X and a part of X. And, you know, those two components, you can get to a milestone to make the go-no-go decision on the second part. Completely different. It's a pharma way of looking at things,
exactly,
right?
Exactly. And the value creation that's created when you get to that next milestone.
So, again, completely de-risk it. Is not what we've done, but I think we've taken a lot of financial risk out of it by saying let's break it into milestones. So that's perhaps a longer answer than you wanted, but any one of the three I think is a really, really viable option for us. Right.
Okay. All right. We're going to take a break for about 15 minutes. Again, I encourage you to go visit our booth and chat with some of our folks over there. We'll come back here at around 10:30.